Hello, everybody, and welcome to another comedian's interview for my blog and podcast, A Rich Comic Life. My name is Richard Gill, and my blog describes my experiences of watching over 1,000 comedians and counting over the last 46 years. I'm delighted to welcome my guest today, live from somewhere in the world. It's Mr. Benjamin Bancolibello. Yeah! Hello, mate. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. You know, I wouldn't do this for everyone. It's because I like you, because I'm on holiday at the moment, but it's okay.
I can see. It looks fantastic, my friend.
No, it's a lovely view, man. It's lovely. It's great. It's a great place. I'm in Gaddad. Lovely place.
Lovely. Brilliant. Well, thank you so much for doing this and taking time out of your holiday.
Yeah.
We're going to be recording for the next 45 minutes to an hour and talk and be all about your comedy career. Thank you so much for doing this. I'd like to go right back to the start and ask you, how did you become a comedian in the first place, please?
Oh, geez. I would call myself as an accidental comic.
Right.
I went to a Nigerian wedding reception. So I know this is not common within English wedding events, but with the Nigerian wedding reception, they would normally have like a host, like an MC.
Yeah.
Similar to what you have at a comedy club, but it's different. And I was a guest at that wedding, and I happened to know the bridegroom, who basically was disappointed by an MC who was supposed to come and host the event. And so he had a quiet word with me to say they couldn't find the MC. He knows I'm naturally funny. I can pull it off. Do I mind hosting the event for him? I was supposed to be there as a guest. I wasn't planning to hold the microphone. But I took the opportunity, and there were about 300 guests. And apparently I did extremely well. I livened everybody up, you know, did my jokes, roasted people. It was a fun event. What I didn't know was that there was a comedy booker at the event who knows a lot about comedy, and he approached me and he said, oh, I have never been to a Nigerian wedding reception where the host is so funny, that you are the life and soul of the party.
Wow.
Have you ever thought of doing stand-up comedy? And I just thought, stand-up comedy, what is that? What is stand-up comedy, you know?
Yeah,
because I didn't know it was called stand-up comedy at the time. I just knew there were people on TV who were with their mics telling their stories, but I just thought it's just a public address. I didn't see the stand-up comedy. But also, I grew up watching a lot of what I would call sketches rather than stand-up. So the likes of Benny Hill, you know, running around, and that's the sort of comedy that I enjoy. So when he said stand-up comedy, I was just a bit confused, and I said, oh, let's go to a place called the Comedy Store, which you will know. And I went to the Comedy Store. They had a gong show, and it happened to be a day when they asked me, they would ask audience members to come on stage. I went up there, did a few jokes, but I didn't even know if I was doing jokes. I just did something. I just said something, and I did very well. And I didn't realize that at the Comedy Store, you'll have other comedy promoters.
Yeah.
Look at what you're doing, and then we'll be interested in you and book you. And so that's how it all began. And I did well at the Comedy Store because it was a gong thing at the time. And then for about 5 gigs after, I just died on my ass. Just literally died. it was death. And I suspect some people will say that when you start stand-up comedy, once you've picked up the mic, it's almost like a drug. I think for me, it was more about the fact that I'd done one gig and I did very well. And the next 5 gigs, I was dying. And I just thought, no, I'm not giving up. I need to find out why. Yeah, exactly. And I haven't looked back ever since. So I call myself an accidental comic. And then I found out that actually, some people say you're not doing stand-up comedy. You're a character comedian. You're not doing stand-up comedy. Oh, there. What the hell is that now? What is character comedy?
That's fantastic, my friend. What an answer. That's great. You know, famously, the two Ronnies on television, they were at the London Palladium. They were sitting in the audience watching, I think it was the Royal Variety Shows. There was some show on, and or they were in it, I think. And there was some fault went wrong with the show. And they were asked to walk on and ad lib whilst there were men, and there was all the comedy promoters in the audience, and that led to the two Ronnies. So similar thing with you.
You never know who's in the audience, honestly, and that's something that's reflected over the years. You never know who's in the audience. The last there was a gig I did recently in character. Someone had seen me at another gig and recommended me to the promoter. And it was a corporate gig and was fantastic. So you never know who's in the audience.
You never know. And I first went to the Comedy Store in 1988 when I first came down to London. And it's one of the best, obviously, it's one of the best comedy clubs going. So to get the experience there doing the Gong Show, it's all about experience, I believe. I tell all the comedians, even if you have good or bad gigs, it's all experience, and you have to keep going. So good on you, my friend.
Thank you.
So your first ever gig, was that the Gong Show?
I wouldn't even say I was doing a gig.
Right.
I didn't even know what a gig was. I just saw it as a public address. But the really proper gig I did was the very first one I did was a gig called it's been such a long time now. It was in St. Albans. It's run by someone called Paul. It used to be run by three people, Paul Revel and two other guys. But I can't remember. It's not called Happy Mondays. It's not called Monday. I can't remember the name of the comedy night.
So many.
But I really do remember this one because I genuinely thought I smashed it that night. And I performed, obviously, in character. But I wasn't wearing a uniform. I was a civilian president. And I did so well. Again, naively, I just thought, this is it. You know, this is it. I'm going to be on TV soon. I'm going to be on TV, Rich, you know?
Brilliant.
But looking back, it was a good gig. I was performing in front of family and friends, and that's totally different from actually performing to strangers. But I was on a high. I just loved the support and what I did. But if I look at that gig now, there were some things I said that I just thought, nah, I wouldn't say them now. This is so painful. But it's all part of the learning process.
But
at the time, geez, I thought I had done I did extremely well, but I just thought the material was just top of the notch, man. That
my friend.
And then 10 years down the line, you look at the set and you wonder, what was that all about? But that's all part of growth. That is all part of growth.
I was gonna ask you, what year was this when you first got up and did your first public address?
I would say it was about 2011, around that time.
Right. So you've obviously gained a lot of experience since then by just gigging.
Brilliant.
I can't imagine you ever having a bad gig. You always make me laugh like a drain when I see you laugh out loud. I think you and the character are hilarious, which we'll come on to in a moment. To date, what has been your best and worst comedy gig?
Okay, the best comedy gig would be when I supported Regina D. Hunter in October 2018.
Wow.
And I was very, very excited that it's one of the biggest gigs I've ever done, supporting such a very big act. And I remember going to Aberdeen, arriving in Aberdeen and seeing a placard and it said, "Welcome, Mr. President." I just thought,
That was fantastic.
You know, for someone who had this creation as far back as 2011, for someone who started really performing at pubs, to then performing in the theater and having coming across the festival and then supporting Regina D. Hunter, that was a great gig. It was a great gig for a number of things. One, Reginald Jim Hunter had never ever seen me. He had just heard about me, and he just took the risk and said, I want him to come and support me for one night. So
fantastic.
It wasn't like he had already seen me.
Yeah.
But he knew that people were talking about me. The second thing was the fact that I was able to win Reginald D. Hunter's fans, because they came to see him. They didn't came to come to see President Obonjo. Who's President Obonjo at the time? Nobody knew who President Obonjo was. So the fact that I was able to win them over, the fact that Reginald D. Hunter's fans were able to go on Twitter and say, who are you? Where have you been? How come you haven't got your own tour? You are hilarious. That was just magical. The third thing was obviously the review. I got lots of reviews as a result of it. So, and it was the very first show that began the Edinburgh Fringe, not the Edinburgh Fringe, the Aberdeen Comedy Festival. And so it was great to be reviewed, and it was a positive review. I just could not believe it. For days, I could not sleep reading the review and reading what people were saying about me on Twitter. And I genuinely thought, this is it once again.
Good man, that is
gonna,
so good.
Yeah, I'm gonna go on a tour. I'm gonna go on a tour with Regina Deontay. It's gonna be all over the place. I'm gonna see a top act. But yeah, it was fantastic. But there was something that happened that almost didn't let that gig happen. So my mom always said I was very clumsy, and she was absolutely right. So I was so excited after we left the airport before the gig, and we went into the hotel room, and they showed me my hotel room. Jeez, man. And you know, when you're saying living the life, and you know, and I had to just remind myself, when I walked into the room, I said to myself, I am a great president. I shouldn't really be excited. I should be used to this sort of I should be used to this sort of hotel room. There's no way. I'm excited about this. Come on, relax.
It's going to your head, my friend.
As soon as they shut the door, I was jumping all over like a little kid who had just opened a packet of, you know, chocolate. I just discovered chocolate. I was
fantastic.
Screaming. And I didn't see this. There's this wardrobe that has some kind of like a cabinet that's, you know, really extended. I didn't realize it was there. And I just hit my head on the cabinet.
Oh.
And then I fell down and I got up and I was saying to myself, what the hell have I just done? I'm in pain. I'm in so much pain.
Oh, mate.
Am I going to do this gig? I've come all the way. Am I going to do this gig? I went into the bathroom and I saw my head was swelling up on this. Oh. And I just thought, geez, I have messed this up. My mom always said I was clumsy. I have messed this up. This gig is not going to go ahead. So I said to myself, calm down. There's no way they're going to know. So far, you don't have a head injury. There's no way they're going to know that this gig it can't take place. You just cover your head with your military hat.
Yeah.
Okay. So I went downstairs to the gig. As I arrived at the gig, I was in a little bit of pain because I could feel that it was swollen.
Yeah.
But I knew I hadn't had a head injury. I was in two minds. Should I tell them? And I thought, if I tell them, that's the end of it. I'm not doing the gig because they might be very worried that I have a head injury and wouldn't want me to be on stage. So I said, no, I'm not going to tell them. And then Regina D. Hunter then came towards me and said, Mr. President, you just have fun, but don't fuck it up.
Oh, that's fantastic.
No, when you said don't fuck it up, I have to say to you, the pain just went.
Oh, Rob, brilliant.
The pain, that's what I needed. The pain just went. Then also, I was already in character mode. And I said, yes, it's your gig, Regina D. Hunter, but you are telling a president, a dictator, not to fuck it up. this gig is so presidential because it was in a theater. And I just thought, I just froze out the fact that it was Regina D. Hunter's gig. And I just thought, this is now my show. These people have come to see me. These are my people. And you know, it was fantastic.
That's incredible.
I came off the stage. The pain had gone. I didn't even tell Regina D. Hunter. I told the organizers later on because I thought the way the room was designed, there was a problem with the cabinet. So they said they were going to do something about it. Yeah. But no, that was my best gig. That was my best.
Wow. That could have been your best and worst gig.
Yeah, it could have been my best and worst gig.
Yeah. That is amazing. That is extraordinary. Let's move on to your wonderful character. Please tell me all about President Obonjo. How was he created? Where did he come from? For people who don't know, this is an extraordinary character. Please describe him to people who don't know, because he's hilarious.
So his name is President Obonjo. He's an African dictator. He's bombastic. He's got charm. He's loud. He intimidates his audience. He's almost like a teddy bear. You just don't know why you love him, but you just love him. And I know that.
I was going to say that.
Yeah, because I was going to say that. People love him because he's the opposite. He's a dictator, but he's the opposite of a dictator. He's a benevolent dictator. Right. He really cares for people. And I think most people, when they see him on stage before he opens his mouth, they think he's a very brutal dictator. But he actually cares about people. And he was created, not that he has any parents. He was just happened one day. And what happened was my real wife was supporting Hillary Clinton during the Obama days. Yeah,
right.
President. So she was supporting Hillary Clinton and I was supporting Obama. And then Obama becomes president. And my wife, just all of a sudden, within a few days, not even a few days, not up to a day, has already started talking about Obama. Obama this, Obama's on TV. Oh, what a nice black man. Blah, 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 blah. And I just thought, I think my wife is attracted to Obama. I think she might end up wanting to sleep with Obama because this obsession, Obama this, Obama, Obama. And I'm not joking. Within a few days, she had bought me two of his books, The Audacity of Hope and Dreams of My Father. And I just thought, what's going on with this? What's going on here? I thought I had a happy life. And all of a sudden, I'm a black man feeling a bit inadequate because my wife is attracted to this handsome guy from America who's now president.
Yeah.
And I thought, how can I save my marriage? I need to save my marriage because my wife is attracted to Obama. So I remember someone gave me the nickname Obonjo in Nigeria. And I just thought, yeah, maybe if I add president to Obonjo, maybe, yeah, that could work. She'll have a president in the house. Maybe eventually she'll stop talking about Obama. And the names are similar, Obonjo, Obama. And at the time I started using the name Obonjo, I had no idea that the derogatory term for Obama was Obongo, which is a racist term. So if you Google Obongo, Obama comes up.
Right.
Because the racists were using that as a way of describing Obama, you know, Obongo the Mongo. So that's what they were doing. But I didn't realize that name was linked to Obama, but it was just so funny that mine was Obonjo and his was Obongo, or they called him Obongo. And that's it. And I believe I succeeded because in terms of saving my marriage.
Off.
Yeah, right. In terms of saving my marriage, because my wife still calls me President Obonjo, has forgotten about Obama.
It's all down to your wonderful wife.
Yeah, exactly. So it was definitely to save my marriage. But then I was performing as a civilian civilian president for a couple of years. And then, right. If you remember, Obama was really the inspiration. And the reason, apart from the fact that, yes, my wife, you know, I'm trying to save my marriage, but also the fact that Obama, as you know, had this catchphrase, yes, we can. And then a couple of years later, he was having some difficulties with the Republican Party. And I just thought, if he was a real African president, how will he behave? He won't behave like a civilian president. He'll behave like a dictator. He will suspend the Constitution. He will lock all the Republicans. Obama needs to be an African dictator. And it's a real shame that he ended up not being an African dictator. The person who ended up being an African dictator was Trump, rather than Obama.
Yeah. That's awful.
Yeah. So that's how the character was created. And
have you let President Obama know that he's the inspiration for the character?
We haven't had the opportunity to meet. We met on Twitter. I've written to him several times. He hasn't responded. I suspect he doesn't want to be associated with a dictator. I probably would have had more success if I linked up with Trump during the time of power. Trump was
good answer.
Trump was friends with Kim Jong-un, friends with Putin. Yeah, you know what I'm saying. So I'm sure if I reached out to Trump. But I was jealous of Trump. I was really jealous of Trump because as a character comedian as president, I used to be one of the funniest dictators in the world until Trump came through.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, but now that he's left, you know, I've got the character has nothing in common with Biden. Nothing in common with Biden in any shape or form.
Where did the Laughter Republic come from?
Okay, so Laughter Republic came from... So I was doing a lot of stuff online before I started performing comedy on stage.
Yeah.
And Laughter Republic was created as a result of my disappointment in the Nigerian government. So Nigeria has gained independence for 60 years and the basic things that you expect people to have is still not there. And people are getting richer and people are getting poorer. But it's, you know, it's just oh, I hope that's not the immigration.
No, just ignore me. They're coming for me. Don't worry about it.
So I was just disappointed. I was disappointed with Nigeria and I was disappointed with Britain in terms of all the things that were happening in Britain, in terms of how Britain treats immigrants. So I just thought, perhaps maybe I just create my own country, create my own utopia. And what would it be like to have an ideal a very good country that, you know, caters and puts smiles on people's lips and, you know, faces and, you know, just a happy country with no problems, no unemployment problems, no immigration problems, no wars with other countries. Just what I'm saying, just a very happy country. And that's why I created Laughter Republic. And also because it was more about putting smile on people's faces. And that's why I call it Laughter Republic. And it didn't matter who you were, what you do, who you sleep with. So if you're a human being and you've got humor, you like humor, if you're black, white, Chinese, brown, yellow, just come and join the country. And that's what I like to do. But I just have that. And it's just really interesting how, even though it's a fictional country, how people want to believe that it really exists. Mm. And there are people who have met me at comedy clubs, who now call themselves Laughter Republicans. I mean,
what you've done is create joy, so they want to be with you and they want to be part of it. It's as simple as that.
Yeah, exactly, and that's the challenge.
And that's wonderful.
That's the challenge of the character, because the comedy, and not many people understand this, the comedy does not end on stage.
Mm.
You know, he does the comedy, but there are still people who follow him who want to interact with him on a regular basis.
I think that's the difference, because we had Al Murray on this podcast, and I asked him, why do you think the pub landlord has lasted so long? And he said, the great thing about the character is that he can say what he likes because he believes in it.
Yeah.
And he's so forceful getting his points across, but it's so endearing as well. And you're exactly the same. It's such a an endearing character that it can run and run and run. You know, it's just wonderful to watch.
Thank you very much. And what's not frightening, but what is really interesting, is that you are the fifth person this week who has spoken to me and has said, oh, the character is very similar to the pub landlord.
Yeah.
In terms of how it's long.
You can see.
And so on that. It's great. It's just the thing with the characters that there are times when I want to switch off from it if I can. So I remember when I used to and I still do it, but not regularly, when audience members will see me perform as Benjamin, and I am performing as Benjamin.
Yeah.
See me perform as President Obonjo. They're in a state of almost anger, like, what have you done with the president? You can't kill off the president. And I'm saying to myself, what have I created? Why can't I just why can't I just get on with my life? You know, why?
Have you tried to experiment with more characters, different characters?
I have, and there are two more which I won't reveal that are out there that are within me. But I think for me, I don't know. It's almost like you performing as yourself and you performing as President Obonjo. And even there have been instances where I go to a comedy club and I want to perform as myself. Okay, so I've been booked as Benjamin. And the MC will come to me several times because psychologically he sees President Obonjo. He doesn't see Benjamin. And he's saying to
Can't get away from it.
Yeah, and he's saying to me, you are Benjamin today, aren't you? Yes, I am Benjamin today. And he goes on stage and then introduces me as President Obonjo.
Oh no.
My greatest fear is that if I start enjoying all the other characters, that I might end up losing interest.
Because
I've done it for so long now. And it's just a world. I mean, there was another gig I did on Saturday. Mm. And I went to the gig. And I didn't dress in uniform to go to the gig. It was in my bag. And the comedy promoter saw me. And he was panicking. He said, where's the president? Where's the president?
The wonderful thing is that he is his own character, that they don't know you're playing him in, as a role. That's wonderful.
Yeah. Even though there's been, if you look at my Facebook page profile, my personal profile, I do post things about him. I mean, it's really interesting how the character has taken almost a life of its own.
Yeah.
At one point, someone said to me, but you don't even tell us who President Obonjo's parents are. You don't tell us a lot about. That's because he was created at the age of 45.
Yeah. but again, you look at somebody like Steve Coogan and Alan Partridge, and you know the longevity of that character. It's extraordinary. Yeah. Once you've hit the jackpot with the characters, you're away.
And actually, someone said to me, would I ever kill President Obonjo? Do I think I'll stop doing President Obonjo, considering that he's a dictator? And you know, bless the woman who died recently, who was a friend of mine, a comedy friend, Lynn Ruth Miller.
I thought that was tragic.
For me, so far I have good health. I don't see how I'm going to stop being President Obonjo. I could be President Obonjo till age 80 something. And you know,
good man. Well, I'll be queuing up to see him.
if you have the likes of Mugabe, leave, what stops me?
Exactly. How do you remember all your jokes and routines as the character, or as doing the stand-up?
I was an accidental comic, and it took a while for me to get to grips with the techniques of comedy. So how do I remember? I think the longer you do it, you know what works for you. So your jokes automatically are in your head.
Yeah.
Obviously, I have a notebook with jokes that work, you know, with some set, you know, headlines of things I want to talk about. So it's really interesting that, and because for 18 months, we stopped performing as comics. And some of us thought that when the first time we go back on stage, that we wouldn't be able to remember our jokes.
Yeah.
But actually, if you've been doing something consistently for so long, in terms of me, I've been in for, 11 years before the pandemic. And some of the jokes that I did, some of them had moved on. Some were still very relevant. But you remember. It's almost like you're not driving for 18 months and then all of a sudden you start driving. You remember those jokes. So I think for me, psychologically, the more you do comedy and the more you understand your act, these jokes are already ingrained in you. Does that make sense?
So very much so.
So tonight I've got a gig at Dulwich Comedy Club performing as President Obonjo. Mark Thomas is going to be there. And I already know the things I want to say.
Yeah.
Political. Yeah. But because I've been talking about it for well over a week now, because I've been performing almost every day, it's there already. It's just
that's brilliant.
Yeah, so that's how for me, unless it'll be really interesting to see. Well, this is what was really interesting. I did a gig on Saturday, and it was for it was in Seven Oaks, and you could tell that the comedy audiences were not really comedy lovers. So I call you a comedy lover because I'm sure you know the techniques of comedy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so there was a joke I was doing at the time in character, but I paused before I got to the punchline. And someone just screamed, "He's forgotten his lines."
No.
Yeah, because she didn't understand that at times you need to pause.
You need to pause for comic effect. Yeah, yeah.
So I just thought, yeah, I'm going to use that. So I said, yeah, you're absolutely right. I have forgotten my lines.
Oh, brilliant. That's so good.
And that's what I used throughout as my callback. Just to, you know, as my callback. So that's
brilliant.
So yeah. So it's for me, it's just there. It's just
fascinating. Yeah. You won the Last Minute Comedian of the Year award in 2016.
Yeah.
And reached the finals of the Natty's New Act of the Year also in 2016, as well as many other competitions. Describe the experiences. What you think competitions are like? Do you think they're good, bad? Do they help you with your career?
I think you just need to be clear, because there are competitions and there are competitions. So there are some competitions that will raise your profile. There are some competitions that would lead to, you know, improving your career. So if you do, for example, reach the finals of a BBC competition, you're almost there, you know, because they take care of all the finalists.
Yeah.
But if you're doing a competition called Looting Comedian of the Year, hello, yeah.
No disrespect to Luton, but I know
what you mean. Disrespect to Luton. No disrespect to Luton or to the organizer. Okay, fine. What do you win? You win a paid gig, and a paid gig is abroad, which is what happened.
Yeah.
It was Luton Comedian of the Year, then that led to Last Minute Comedian of the Year. And then you get more gigs, and it's good. You get, you know, it raises your profile.
Yeah.
New Act of the Year. That was the what they call the Hack the Empire. That was great. In terms of experience and exposure, it was great exposure, because that was the first time I was properly reviewed by industry people. So there were judges there from the industry, and they made their views on what they thought about the act. And it was just brilliant. It was just 2016 was really, really brilliant in terms of reviews by the industry. So it's a lovely feeling. But I think you just need to be clear. I think for me, there are two types of comedians. There are comedians who do this as a hobby, and there are people who do this strategically because it's a career for them.
Yes, yeah.
So my advice is that if you see this as a career, then you need to be selective about the sort of competitions you go for. So So you think you're funny. Yeah? You can only do that once.
Yeah.
So that for me, that's more for people who want to become, you know, career comedians, if that makes any sense. The same with BBC comedy competitions. So what I'm saying is that the experience is based on how it feels. It is based on what sort of competition it is. Yeah, does that make sense?
Yeah, very much so. Yeah.
I appreciated every single competition I because that is also an opportunity to be seen by industry people.
Yeah.
Would an industry person see you performing at Luton Comedy Club or Luton Comedian of the Year? Or would an industry person see you at BBC?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's just being clear about...
I totally understand. Yeah.
But there's a joke here, because I also won the Malcolm Hardy Award 2019.
Congratulations, what a legend.
And guess who won that award? As well, Trevor Noah.
Oh, fantastic.
But this is the thing. Trevor Noah won the Malcolm Hardy Award in 2012. And last night, he was at the O2.
Wow.
President Obonjo won the same award in 2019. Where was President Obonjo last night? At a Walker Men's Club.
Well, I tell you, my friend, Trevor Noah's not talking to me today.
I know. Someone responded.
Pleasure.
Someone responded and said, Obonjo, 2012. Trevor Noah, at least more than 7 years. It's going to take you 7 years. I will see you at the O2 when you're changing your phone contract.
Oh, thank you very much. That's great. Yeah. Your character, the president, is exceptionally confident on stage whenever I've seen him. Do you suffer from any nerves before you go on stage? And if so, how do you cope with them?
Do I suffer from any nerves? I think there was one I did probably a couple of weeks ago, and it wasn't nerves. It was just more, I'm not sure whether it was nerves. It was at a golf club. Right. And it was full of retired white people.
Right.
Retired were very, very rich. As soon as I walked in, I could just tell, I could smell money. I could smell slave trade money. I could just smell money.
Yes.
And I just thought, there were certain things I wanted to say that I thought wouldn't work there. So there's stuff I do about TikTok, because I've gone viral, the character has gone viral on TikTok. And these are always
too old for that.
So in my head, I was just thinking, okay, fine. This is what I wanted to say for 20 minutes. But actually, I've seen the audience. Some of the stuff is not going to work. What can I bring in to make it work? You know, how can I make it more relevant? And I wouldn't say it was nerves, but it's just, you get a bit jittery a little bit about, oh, do you think this is your 20-minute material is going to actually work in front of this audience, especially they're retired, they're rich, they're,
yeah,
you know, yeah. And you know, so yeah, they're going to look at you like a work of art, you know, like hanging on the wall.
All dependent on the audience.
And then what was really interesting, this is an important point. When I walked into the room, I saw the Queen's portrait.
Right.
And there's something I do when I'm in character, I get people to pledge allegiance to me. And it was clear that these are all royalists. And then this African dictator is coming, asking royalists to get off. Yeah. And then I just thought, I will definitely be reminding them of Idi Amin Dada. I will definitely be reminding them of Idi Amin Dada. And what's really interesting is after the gig, a few people came to me and said, I was in Zimbabwe, or I was in Kenya. You know, that's how old.
Yeah, they were. Yeah.
I remember the days when Idi Amin took over, or all the things he did with the, you know, all the letters he sent to the Queen. So it's.
Wow. Let's move on to Edinburgh. I am very fortunate to be able to go to the Edinburgh Fringe every year. I didn't go this year and I didn't go last year, but I'm going to return next year. But I've been every year since 2005. And I go and see about 50 shows a week, every time I go in the middle week that I'm there. And I'm absolutely shattered, but I have the best time. Can you tell me, what was your first Edinburgh Fringe like? What year was it? What experiences did you have from it?
Well, very good question. And it was probably the defining moment in terms of how there was no way I could look back and say I would stop doing comedy. I did a show called President Obonjo Stole My Identity. And it was an hour show, of which 45 minutes of it was President Obonjo. And then I reveal the real me. And I say, I'm fed up with the character. I want my life back because he's sleeping with my wife, you know, taking my... I was in Edinburgh for 2 weeks, just 2 weeks. And I was in a place called the Cowgate Head.
Yeah.
The Fringe. You know, no disrespect to Cowgate Head. But, you know, now I look back and I say, would the president play the Cowgate Head again? Definitely no, because the president needs to be at the Pleasance. The president needs to be
The
president shouldn't be at Cowgate Head. But at the time, I had no idea what Edinburgh Fringe was about. I had no idea. Someone just saw me in Stuart Logan, who has to be Scottish, saw me at a place in somewhere in South London. I was doing a preview there, and he said, "Oh, Bonjo, do you want to come to Edinburgh Fringe?" I said, "What is it?" He said, "It's a festival." I said, "Okay, cool." let's go. So I did a two-hander with him, and I did my one-hour show as president of Bonjour. I had no idea that at times you needed a director. I had no idea that you had to get reviewers in. I had no idea how audiences came through. All I did was I knew I had a show. I knew I had this act. I knew I'd got a room. And I knew that the act was going to be popular. So I started walking around the streets, distributing leaflets. Before I knew what was happening, people were saying, there's a dictator in town. I was like a walking poster. I had flyers, but it does me walking around the streets of Edinburgh in 2015. Anyway, cut long story short. So I did my first night, and the next day I saw someone had written stuff about me, and it was John Fleming.
Right.
And he had written about how brilliant the character was, and the show was just mental, and that it's unfortunate that he probably won't be discovered at the Fringe because he's not a well-known act. He hasn't got a producer. He hasn't got a production company, but he's at Cowgate Head. That blog that he did, because it was more of a blog rather than a review, everybody read that, and reviewers came to the show. Now, I have to say to you, when I was performing, I had no idea that reviewers were in the room. I didn't even know what reviewers were. I did what I did, and then boom, 4-star, 5-star reviews.
Wow.
Yeah, the 5-star review was from the Fringe Guru. The 4-star review was from We Review. Once again, there are reviews and there are reviews.
Yeah.
But it was brilliant to get those reviews because people then knew who President Obonjo was because it was just an industry review and people just
heard. Yeah.
I didn't know Edinburgh Fringe that you had to do a full month. Mm. I did 2 weeks. I did 2 weeks. I just did 2 weeks, boom, and I was out.
But it's all about exposure when you're there, I think, though. So the more people that get to see you, the more known you become.
Yeah. But you just need to be clear about why you're going to Edinburgh. Are you going to Edinburgh with exposure? Are you going there to be discovered? Are you going there to make money? Do you understand what it's like in Edinburgh because there are, believe it or not, I'm sure you know that. Edinburgh reflects our society. So we've got the free fringe.
Yeah.
And we also have the paid fringe.
Yeah.
Okay. There are reviewers who will not go to the free fringe.
Right.
Yeah. Because they'd rather pursue a paid fringe. There are reviewers who will definitely go to the paid fringe. You see, they don't tell you these things. You cover them unless you have someone who guides you and talks you through these things. Because most comics, when they first start, unless they're lucky and they get picked up, all we are focusing on is just performing and getting better. Yeah? They don't tell you all the other things behind it.
Yeah.
Nobody told me, Rich, that, go with the 30 minutes first, and then next year go with 45 minutes, and the next year go with an hour. I just went in, boom, with an hour. boom.
And that was it.
And that's it. Exactly. So, I genuinely have no regrets.
No.
Doing it the way I did it because I had to learn it hard way, but it was the best way because, we're all not going to be picked up or noticed by the industry.
Yeah.
So you've got to find other ways. This act is more of a, you hear people talk about, oh, this person is a comedian's comedian. I actually see President Obonjo as an audience comedian.
Yeah. What is fascinating is you're saying about reviews and blogs and all the rest of it. How I started my blog, it was just my experiences, and it still is just my experiences of watching all the comedians. I had to go on I was invited to go on a half-day writing course, which I went on, and everybody around me wanted to be reviewers. And the woman came up to me and she said, "We've forgotten why we've invited you." And I said, "Well, I'm not a reviewer. I'm not a diarist. I'm not a reporter. I'm not a critique. I'm a member of the audience and I'm out to have a good time. So my blog will hopefully reflect what it's like being an audience member in such a positive environment."
Yeah.
And they never bothered me again.
and well done for doing that because we need more of you like that. Because like I said, not everybody is going to get reviewed.
Yeah.
Now, not all the reviewers are going to like what you do.
Yeah.
who are the key people? I really feel very strongly about this. And this is one of the reasons why I still do comedy. I do comedy for my audience. Yeah. I do comedy to make people laugh.
Exactly.
I cherish the feedback I get from my audiences. I mean, yeah. I went to a Walkerman's club last night. And we know that at times when audiences talk, and they've just seen you, they're quite emotional. It's almost like you make love to a woman and you promise everything, you know, even though you don't want to give her everything.
But yeah, yes, yeah.
Buy your car. And this guy said this
That's
to me.
Magic.
This guy said this to me yesterday, and I know he meant it. And he said, "President Obonjo, you came into Walkerman's club and you turned this club into a theater."
I mean, what more?
Exactly. So, when you take that feedback compared to a reviewer who may well not like your act and reviews you badly, which one are you going to go for?
Exactly. It's all about who turns up, who making an audience laugh. It's as simple as that.
Yeah.
If you can do that and you can do that very, very well, you've achieved your aim.
Yeah.
I saw your solo show in 2015. I was at Cowgate and I saw President Obonjo Stole My Identity. I thought it was fantastic. I even chatted to you outside as you gave me a flyer.
it was so good.
I've seen you do that show and I've seen you many times live. And I saw you online last year doing a presidential address for Beefy's Comedy.
Yeah,
as well, which was fantastic. Do you have a writing process? And if you do, where do you get your ideas for your shows and routines from? I know you've touched on this before, but do you go in with a specific theme for a show that he's going to talk about? Or how does it work?
Well, so the writing process has taken so many forms. So yeah. Previously, what I used to do was I'll have ideas of things I want to say on stage and I'll just jot them down and I'll just go on stage, say them. If they're funny, keep them and start building my set.
Right.
That's it. It's that simple.
Brilliant.
And that's what used to happen for so many years. I was never ever the comic who will sit down and say, okay, fine, let me go into a coffee shop
and just
write stuff. My writing actually took place on stage.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. But there's a risk to that. There's a risk because it might not work or you might just be all over the place. But it was the best writing process and it's still the best writing process for me. So everything I have said over the years is because I've said it on stage, it's worked, boom. And then with stuff that will happen tonight that I know will be funny that I haven't written, but it's in my head or it just happens because there's something that happens. Yeah. For example, I'll give you a good example. So the Seven Oaks gig I went to was in a place called Knockholt. And the president never ever pronounces any of these names properly. He's just So he basically said, it's Knockbolt. And then people just laughing. So he said to himself, Knockbolt. And they said, no, it's not Knockbolt. The correct name is Knockholt. I said, yeah, well, whatever it is, he's not English. You said he wasn't English. Why would you expect me to pronounce an English word when I'm not English? Can you pronounce an African village name properly? No, you can't. And he went, and he went on a rant. And he said, by the way, knock bolt or knock hold, whatever it is. Look at you. You all look like you're knocking each other. You know, you're just knocking each other.
What is great about it off the top of your head is that it keeps you on your toes as well.
Yeah, exactly. And I think for me, the audience appreciate the fact that they saw you do stuff immediately.
Yeah, yeah.
And for me, the stuff that happens immediately that's spontaneous really attracts me to comedy. And actually, it's more that is why I'm so drawn to the writing process on stage. Another example was yesterday. This was at the Walking Men's Club. And there was a woman who was hyperventilating while the president was performing.
It's She must have been pleased to see you.
I don't know whether she was pleased to see me or whether she was planning some kind of, eventually, maybe there might be some kind of, I don't know what she was planning, but I was on stage as the character and I noticed that there was some mumbling, that someone was out of breath. So can you imagine? That's not what you expect. You don't go to a place to go and perform and someone is out of breath. So in my mind, and this is the psychological thing, there's the Benjamin that is saying, okay, stop the gig, go out and attend to her. But there's a president who's a dictator. What would a dictator do? What would a dictator do who is out of breath? Of course, he will enjoy the situation. So,
turn it with a frown.
So in character, I basically said, okay, this is happening. Okay, is she okay? Are you sure she's okay? And they said, yeah, she's okay, then she'll settle down. I said, can you imagine the news flash tomorrow? African dictator kills elderly woman.
Oh, dear me.
And they were laughing. So for me, the writing process doesn't end on you just, you know, doing stuff that you haven't done on stage. But the beauty of the writing process, as far as I'm concerned, is the fact that you're on stage and something happens and you can do it, or you just eat off the cuff, something happens, boom.
That is wonderful. Let's move on. How have you found, have you done many online gigs, and how have you found them as opposed to live gigs?
They will never ever be like live gigs. And I know there were quite a number of people who were reluctant to embrace online gigs as soon as the pandemic began. However, my view is, whilst I recognize that they're not like live gigs, but for someone like me, they were very useful in terms of me keeping in touch with my fans. So I used to do one-off Zoom gigs with my audience, people who I'd met at other clubs. And also, I didn't realize some of the disability access issues. So there were quite a number of people who never went to live comedy shows because they were disabled and couldn't have access to it. But all of a sudden, the online gigs gave them the opportunity to see as many comics, you know, half naked, watching the president. So it was no longer a case of whether I enjoyed them. It was more about the fact that there were people out there who wanted to have some kind of entertainment and enjoyment. And that was the opportunity.
I totally agree, because I went to a lot of online gigs. I went to Always Be Comedy. I went to Happy Mondays. I went to The Return of the Crack, Jarlath Regan's one on a Friday. And there were excellent substitutes when they were done really well. They were really good substitutes for the room. But for me, you can't beat live, because you, as you said earlier, you never know what you're going to get live on stage, because you're in the moment.
I just loved the fact that it took us to it's a different skill.
Yeah.
You performing on Zoom or online. And I picked up things that I wouldn't have done on a live stage. The thought of the fact that I, as a dictator or president, would do a gig online and I couldn't get people to stand up and pledge allegiance to me.
I bet you tried.
Yeah. Apart from the fact that some of them were half naked, it didn't possible. Yeah, but also the fact that they were half naked watching a world leader in their rooms or in their living rooms. How many people, they don't do that with their real world leaders. So there was so much material that came out from the Zoom. And at times when my internet wasn't working, I tell them I was, you know, in Africa and there was an issue with the internet service. There's so much stuff that you can do. So for me, I think the question should be, how do you adapt to change? How do you embrace change? Because no one saw the pandemic coming. No one saw that we were going to have to do online gigs. And the people who did well at online gigs are the people who embraced change immediately.
Very much so.
Adapted their style and boom.
Yeah. The first very early ones I went to, they had the front row virtual audience and the comedians on the stage. So the comedians could see this front row virtual audience. But initially there was no audio. Yeah. So when I was laughing with my loud laugh, I was belting out a loud laugh, but laughing at four walls. I thought I was going to be taken away because they couldn't hear me. You know, I was like, ha! But I couldn't be heard. And then they opened up the audio on the front row, and the comedians could then time a joke, chat to the audience. It worked really well. And they did, as I say, they did the very best that they could do with it. But as I say, for me, you cannot beat live. Who are your favourite comedians, past and present?
It's very difficult because when people ask me who are the comedians, the president doesn't actually see himself as a comedian.
Of course not. Of course, it's a rough question to ask.
Yeah. So he sees himself as a politician, and one of his frustrations at the moment is the fact that he's on the bill with comedians, but he's not on the bill with politicians. So if I was answering the question as the act as President Obonjo, I would say it's Kim Jong-un, Putin, yeah. Assad, you know.
Benjamin?
On a serious note, I liked Benny Hill. I know he wasn't a stand-up comedian. I liked Benny Hill. I liked George Carlin.
Oh, brilliant!
I liked Bill Hicks, Richard Pryor.
Yes,
Eddie Murphy. I struggle with. I wouldn't say I don't like British comedians, but I would say that the person who really comes and springs to mind for me would be Lee Nelson.
Brilliant. Oh, what a choice.
In terms of character comedy. So not necessarily straight stand-up comedy, but more, you know, character comedy.
Character-based comedy.
Yeah, there's Al Murray. I haven't seen him live, but I've seen him. Marcel Leconte. So you can see why I'm drawn to actually
character-driven
comedy rather than straight stand-up.
It's interesting because the very first comedian I ever saw was Les Dawson on holiday in Scarborough with the family, and a year later we saw Tommy Cooper. This was in the 70s.
Yep.
And I've seen just about everybody ever since. I've been very lucky. But in Manchester in 1992, somewhere around there, we saw Bill Hicks live, and he was just incredible. He came on at midnight and he did an hour. Mm-hmm. And no matter what he said, you were just drawn in and you were listening to what he was saying. It's very much in that respect like your character. Mm-hmm. The president, when you say, I'm going to do a presidential address, you're in and you're listening what have you got to say? And you're not necessarily trying to find the jokes. You're trying to find the point of what you're saying.
Which makes
it 10 times more funny. Yeah. And it's so wonderful to see.
Thank you. I mean, there was a comment yesterday as well that got me thinking. And that person said, I was just so much in awe of the dictator. I have never ever loved a dictator in my life. Why would I want to love a dictator? But I don't know why, I just love this dictator. And it felt like you were on stage and I was watching a film.
That's exactly it.
You mentioned Tommy Cooper. That was the name that I wanted to mention as well. I'm also drawn to, I just love the fact that you go on stage, and someone did it yesterday, and it also happens to me as well. There's someone called David Locke.
You must
know him. He's a young comic. And he just went on stage, and for a few minutes he didn't say anything, and people were just laughing. People were just in awe of his persona.
There's this next level where they go on and they either twiddle their glasses like Eric Morecambe. I would have loved to have seen Morecambe with Tommy Cooper.
Those
many that have got that, and you just think, why am I laughing? You haven't done anything.
Exactly. And I must say that I'm not drawn to comedy that is spoken and it's intelligent, but geez, I think that those moments like the Tommy Cooper are those moments where you're able to just go on stage and not say anything is a work of art as far as I'm concerned. I mean the other day, because it was all about COVID, so I was given a mic and then I was given a wipe, and so the president was wiping his mic, and while he was wiping his mic, everybody was just laughing.
So you've achieved it.
Yeah. And then he said, "But I'm president. Why am I wiping this? Just gonna wipe this mic for me."
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So it's just those.
It's just magic.
Those are the magical moments. Those are the magical.
Tommy Cooper, when we saw him, he walked on stage to thunderous applause, and then he just went, "Good night, everybody," and walked off. And that was genius. And then came back up again.
But you see that. I don't know whether it was like that, the way it is now. Where my view is that some people want to teach you how to do comedy.
Yeah.
Comedy.
You've got to be natural, I think.
Yeah, my view is that you've got to be natural and you've got to have your own voice. Obonjo is his own voice.
Yeah, exactly.
Omar is his own voice. Marcel Lukonde is his own voice.
Yeah.
Stuart Lee is his own voice. I can never be Stuart Lee. Stuart Lee can never be Obonjo. They say he's racist if he tries it. So, you know, it's
very good. Yes.
Yeah.
I this has been an absolute joy chatting to you. It really has today.
Thank you
so much. Just before we go, is there anything else you'd like to say? Do you have any planned tours coming up? Do you have any online gigs? Where can people find you on social media?
I haven't got any on tour yet, but I'm hoping that will happen.
Yeah.
The biggest project is I'm launching my own comedy night. It's called Laughter Republic Comedy Congress.
Oh, so, my friend, I'm going to be there.
Yeah. So I've got a logo. I'm looking for a venue. It has to be a venue that is presidential. You know, it can't be a pub gig. You know, it has to be a venue that when you walk in there, you say, "Oh my, this is a pre." It's almost like a political meeting. Sorry,
that's going to be something special.
It has to be something special. Like, even I want a venue where you come in, you're already laughing, you already feel that this is funny, because you have to argue, what is an African dictator doing running a comedy night? What?
You've got to work out a good reason why.
Why is he running a comedy night? So I want something different, and I'm taking my time. The logo has been publicized.
Yeah.
Everybody likes the logo.
Yeah.
So it's just finding the right venue. And you know, if it wasn't because of the way things were, don't see how it wasn't possible for him to run, the president to run a comedy night at number 10 Downing Street.
My friend. I'm with you on that one.
Yeah. Or the House of Commons. Or the House of Commons. There must be some House of Commons. There must be a room in the House of Commons.
Yeah.
On a serious note, it has to be presidential, because it's a presidential night. And the whole idea is that comedians will come and perform from various countries.
Sure.
Comedians based in the UK. And they just do their thing for comics. But I want something. I know that people are still very apprehensive. I think the places that are doing well at the moment are the established clubs. So I know I've got my work cut out, but I think the president can do it.
I think you can as well. And as I say, I will be first in the queue. It's such a great idea, as is your character. It's
Thank you.
A wonderful, wonderful character that made me laugh such a lot over the years.
It's been
an absolute delight talking to you. It really has.
Yeah, thank you so much. I would say that the president will be jealous that he wasn't the one who was invited to talk.
Well, we might have to do another one with him.
Yeah, who knows.
All the best, my friend, and thank you so much.
Thank you, bye.